Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The scenes from Aleppo have been excruciating, the hesitance of many to get involved sharp. But is there a necessary reckoning here? For 4,000 years, says former UN Undersecretary Jan Egeland, Aleppo gave to world civilization. And world civilization was not there, he says, when Aleppo needed it most. This hour On Point, a moral accounting for what the world has let happen in Syria, in Aleppo. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is there, was there, no duty to protect here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New York is Ben Taub, contributor to The New Yorker and NewYorker.com. He's reported extensively from Syria and the region, covering the Syrian civil war and the possible war crimes committed throughout the ongoing five-year conflict there. Ben Taub, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Listen for us with us for just a second here, Ben. This is sound from a video uploaded to social media. Claims to show civilians trying to evacuate eastern Aleppo as gunfire is heard during a negotiated ceasefire. Some scene of evacuation. And here, I referenced his quote, but here, Ben, is Jan Egeland, Secretary General now of the Norwegian Refugee Council. At a press conference just last week, he said the world civilization was not there to assist the people of Aleppo when they needed us the most.
We feel all strongly that the history of Aleppo through this war will be a black chapter in the history of international relations. It took 4,000 years to build Aleppo, hundreds of generations. One generation managed to tear it down in 4 years.
And here, Ben, the Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon.
I have said before that we have collectively failed the people of Syria. The Security Council has not exercised its preeminent responsibility with regard to the maintenance of international peace and security. History will not easily absolve us.
Ben Taub, history will not easily absolve us, the UN Secretary General says there. Of course, the UN Security Council today, this morning, unanimously voting to send observers in to oversee the further evacuation of civilians after such a by fits and starts process there. You've done so much reporting on this region, Ben. How do you begin to think about the moral accounting for what we have all watched? It's been pretty much in plain view over these last 4 or 5 years and in these last months as the crisis in Aleppo has come to a head.
Yeah, well, I would agree with both of them that history will not easily absolve us, and particularly the institution of the United Nations, which was tasked with, I mean, created with the intention and tasked with preventing this kind of atrocity, and yet, in fact, has in certain ways, by its inaction, been awfully close to something that looks like complicity. And by that, I mean, really, for instance, the United Nations said in June that if civilians continue to be starved and surrounded in under siege, they would start doing airdrops of food and medicine into areas that were not being allowed, they weren't being allowed to deliver aid. And then they never did. And even now, in order for this the United Nations to send food or medicine into areas under siege, they ask the government of Syria every single day. They've been asking for the past 5 months for Aleppo since it went under siege in July, and they haven't been able to deliver because the Syrian government says no. And at a certain point, you have to ask, I mean, the UN was drafted and this amazing document called the Rome Statute, which is the founding document of the International Criminal Court, and it was drafted in 1998, and it defines extermination literally, and this is a direct quote, as the deprivation of access to food and medicine calculated to bring about the destruction of part of a population. So when they sit back and do nothing while that is happening for months and months and months, and in fact throughout Syria over the course of several years, What is the institution for if it can't deliver aid to areas under siege? And really what it is that it's completely mired in politics. Geopolitics takes priority over human rights. Geopolitics takes priority over any path to justice. The International Criminal Court, as I mentioned, you know, it was created as to be some sort of deterrent to the widespread systematic perpetration of war crimes. And yet, because Syria never ratified the treaty, the Rome Statute, the only way for the ICC to have jurisdiction in Syria would be for the UN Security Council to vote to refer jurisdiction, which, of course, the Russians blocked in 2014. And now that Russia is actively committing war crimes in Syria, the referral mechanism would be for Russia to vote itself to be tried at the ICC, which is preposterous. It's not going to happen. And it's not just the Assad regime that's committing crimes. There are rebel groups committing crimes. Yesterday, an affiliate of al-Qaeda, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, the former al-Qaeda group in Syria, blocked buses from going to another area, Fua and Kafraya, these two Shiite villages that needed to be evacuated as well. There are wounded Shiite civilians. And they blocked the buses and then set them on fire. That is the prevention of what would be an evacuation, and that's a war crime as well. You also have, well, even defining it as an evacuation of Aleppo is awfully treacherous, and I think the wrong word. The correct word is a forced deportation or a forced displacement. And the reason that the Russians and the Syrians and, frankly, the UN are not calling it that is because that's a crime against humanity in the founding document of the ICC. It's very, very unambiguous. It's clearly defined. And if there's any question as to whether it's evacuation or forced deportation, here's a leaflet that was dropped by Russian or Syrian jets a week before this began. It said, and this is a direct quote, "If you do not leave these areas quickly, you will be annihilated. You know that everyone has given up on you. They left you alone to face your doom."
Ben, the UN is not made up of gods. It's made up of nations. And of course that means there will be geopolitics. What's happened here? I mean, when you look back across, look at the Balkans, look at Cambodia, look at Rwanda. Are we in different territory here, or is this simply something that has proven beyond human capacity to deliver on, despite the Rome Statute and much more?
I think that we are, it's hard to say. I mean, we're certainly in the same territory in terms of scale of criminality. This cannot go unaccounted for. I'm not sure that while the world was very, very slow and late to act in preventing further criminality in those places, I don't think there was any question that there would be tribunals set up to deal with it after the fact, and that the high and highest level war criminals would be hunted down and tried. In Syria, that's very much in question. And that is very upsetting. And one of the implications is that powerful countries or countries that have powerful friends can essentially use the Rome Statute as not as a list of prohibitions, but as almost a manual for carrying out the most humiliating campaign to destroy any opposition and face no justice down the line. And, you know, the United States certainly is quite loud on the world stage about its adherence and interest in human rights, but its incoming president is not. And he's inheriting a world in which, you know, human rights don't particularly seem to matter. War crimes don't particularly seem to matter if you're strong enough to get away with them. And the United States is not a member of the ICC either. Neither is Russia. So, again, the referral mechanism is the United States. If the United States began committing, you know, hypothetically committing widespread systematic war crimes in some part of the world, the referral mechanism is not necessarily strong enough to bring about any aspect of justice. So the decay of these institutions carries very serious future implications.
Ben, you've done such vivid reporting on this. Make it real for us. Just how deep the offenses to humanity, if you will, have been here. We see the broad description. We see the hunger. We see the bombardment that has left Aleppo in absolute ruins. We watch the refugees, or call them the would-be evacuees, or those being forced out of town, sort of fleeing under fire over the weekend. But take us deeper into your reporting, just how dark this has been.
Sure. When the war began, some of the first war crimes to be carried out were the detention, the illegal detention and torture and murder of all people deemed to be or thought to be opposition, suspected of opposition. And this was a widespread campaign. So I wrote about a group called the Commission for International Justice and Accountability. They are were set up in response to this jurisdictional vacuum. And what they did is they sent Syrian activists and lawyers, and they trained them in what kinds of evidence actually serve a trial. And that's actually not what we're seeing a lot. We see all these thousands and thousands and thousands of videos of hospitals being blown up, of, you know, headless children being carried into hospital wards, of bodies left in the streets covered in dust because anyone who tries to go and retrieve them gets shot by snipers as well. We've seen videos of rescuers getting blown up because the planes circle back to kill anyone who tries to retrieve the injured. We've seen all of this stuff, but that stuff is actually kind of, and I hate to use this word, but pretty close to useless when it comes to accountability, because what matters in a trial is pinning the crimes on an actual person. And so what this group did is, rather than focus on all the human rights atrocities, is they went into Syria and they started collecting Syrian government documents, internal documents through which you can rebuild the chain of command. And this was aided by, in 2012 and 13, the rebels capturing large portions of territory that included local security branches of the intelligence agencies, military intelligence, Air Force intelligence, and so on. And they would go in to these captured facilities, take out all the documents, smuggle them across borders at great risk to themselves. One of them was killed. Several have been captured by ISIS and by the regime. And then send these documents back to an office in Western Europe, where a large team of analysts, lawyers, and translators pored through them and reconstructed the Syrian government's chain of command. And what they were able to do with this vast, they smuggled 600,000 documents out. And they were able, and some of these documents have Assad's signature on them. They were able to trace the systematic torture and murder of tens of thousands of people in these detention facilities from 2012 and 13 and 11 to an order that was drafted by Assad's highest level security committee, signed by Assad himself, and then sent down the chain of command for implementation.
Bintel, please stand by right there.
His guilt is not in question.
We have to take a short break. We'll come back and look at just that. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the agonies in Aleppo, the world's duty to protect, and maybe a moral accounting for what's going on, what's gone on in Syria. Ben Talbot's with us. He's written extensively, reported extensively for The New Yorker, out of the country and the region. Richard Norton and Martha Myers join us in just a moment. You can join us as well. Is there a duty to protect that falls on all of us when a country goes to hell or threatens to? And is Syria where we've drawn the line and said that's more than we can handle? Is that okay? And what do you do with the images we've seen out of Aleppo? Do you just turn away? Here's U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry last week railing against the humanitarian crisis in Syria, talking about the violence, the attacks in Aleppo, other rebel-held areas of the divided country.
There is absolutely no justification whatsoever for the indiscriminate and savage brutality against civilians shown by the regime and by its Russian and Iranian allies over the past few weeks, or indeed for the past 5 years.
Savage brutality, and Kerry went on and on. But okay, so what? Here was the Zayed Raad al-Hussein. This is UN High Commissioner for Human Rights talking in the fall about the shelling of rebel-held areas of Aleppo, how they should be considered criminal acts.
These violations constitute war crimes, and if knowingly committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack directed against civilians, they constitute crimes against humanity. The collective failure of the international community to protect civilians and halt this bloodshed should haunt every one of us.
Collective failure. Those in the region maybe long ago stopped counting on more than they've got. This is Abdulkafi Almado. This is an English teacher in Aleppo. He released one of these goodbye videos on Twitter that have been coming out as Russian bombardment and the Iranian-backed militias and the Syrian forces have moved in. Hundreds of these have been posted on social media from the besieged city in recent weeks. Here's his.
What I want to say is, don't believe anymore in the United Nations. Don't believe anymore in the international community. Don't think that they are not satisfied with what's going on. They are satisfied of that we are being killed, that we are facing one of the most difficult or the most serious or the most horrible massacre that is in the new history.
But he doesn't believe, he says, anymore in the international community. Ben Taub, please stand by in New York. Martha Myers joins us right now. She's country manager for Turkey for the ARC Group. It's a development stabilization consultancy out of Dubai. They got funding from Canada, the U.S., the U.K., and more. Former country director for Syria for Save the Children International, joining us via Skype from Bennington, Vermont. Martha Myers, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
How do you see moral accountability for what has happened in Syria? Where do you place it?
Well, I certainly agree with what Ben said about the feckless complicity of the United Nations with the regime in Damascus. I think, in part, I part ways in that the UN does not have a military force, and at this point, and for many years, a military force has been required. The Assad regime has made it absolutely clear that they will not adhere to any international norms in terms of protection of civilian rules of war. And the groups that have military force that could have protected the people of Aleppo, and I'd like to say that Aleppo, in a way, is simply a natural conclusion. This kind of encirclement, starvation, torture, abuse of civilian populations has been standard fare of the Assad regime, and there are many examples in Syria where they continue to do this and have done it again. So Aleppo should come as no surprise to the international community. I believe the duty to protect rests not just on the UN, but squarely on us. The governments that participate in this thing called the coalition, which are mostly the Western governments, including the United States. I am not a military person. I'm a humanitarian and development person. But I confess, as a human being, watching the acute suffering of Syrians and the acute suffering of Aleppo, how we can have fighter jets in the skies just a few miles down the road over Raqqa and Membij and be bombing every day, and we can do absolutely nothing to protect the civilians of eastern Aleppo. You know, Mr. Kerry's words that you played, I agree with his words, but where has the administration been in terms of actually raising a finger to help protect innocent Syrian civilians? We have been nowhere. We have done nothing. And again, we have had years of this. Since the beginning of the uprising, the revolution in March 2011, we had the quote-unquote red line about the use of chemical weapons. Not only were more than 1,000 civilians killed by a chemical weapon fired by the regime outside Damascus in 2013, we then did very little. We did organize, and the international community organized and oversaw removal of chemical weapons, but we still see the use of chlorine gas and phosphorus, both of which are not permitted weapons on civilian populations. So I hold Western governments also culpable, and I think the words of the teacher in Aleppo are very poignant, and from my experience, and I've lived in the region for my entire adult life, his words, his sentiment, which is basically, you all are okay with this. The proof is in the pudding. You are okay with what you are watching happen, is a sentiment that is broadly shared throughout the region. And this does not bode well for any of us, Tom.
Last week at the UN, the UN ambassador there, Samantha Power, was pointing fingers at Russia, at Iran, of course, the Syrian government. I mean, these are the direct implementers of what's going on there right now. She was pretty tough on them. Here she was on Tuesday before the UN Security Council.
When one day there is a full accounting of the horrors committed in this assault of Aleppo, and that day will come sooner or later, you will not be able to say you did not know what was happening. You will not be able to say you were not involved.
You will not be able to say, but what about the U.S.? Here was John McCain, Senator John McCain, Republican out of Arizona, on CNN's State of the Union yesterday, saying a failure of American leadership was behind the crisis.
This is the sign of a possible unraveling of the world order that was established after World War II, which has made one of the most peaceful periods in the history of the world. We're starting to see that the strains and the unraveling of it, and that is because of an absolute failure of American leadership.
Failure of American leadership. But where do you want to point the finger here? We can look back through history. We can look at Somalia. We can look at Iraq. We can look at Libya and say, okay, American intervention, did that work out so very, very well? Martha Myers, please stand by there with Ark Ben-Taub in New York. Richard Norton joins me now in the studio, professor of anthropology and international relations at Boston University's Frederick Pardee School of Global Studies. He looks at intersectarian relations in the Middle East and Muslim thought there, reformist thought. Richard Norton, thanks very much for being here today.
Tom, it's nice to be with you again and with your listeners.
Where does the moral accountability for what we're seeing fall? Is it everywhere? Is everybody responsible? Is nobody responsible? Is John McCain right? We've got an unraveling here and this is just the new way of the world?
I don't intend to absolve the United States of responsibility. However, let's point to the main culprits to begin with. A basic premise of the laws of warfare are that civilians should not be directly targeted. About 400,000 people have been killed in Syria, many of them civilians, 90%, perhaps more, Human Rights Watch estimates 95%, have been killed by the government and allied forces to the government. So these are the main perpetrators of evil. From 2011, when the uprising began, up until now, more than 275 hospitals have been attacked in 400 separate attacks, some multiple attacks on the same hospital. 90% of those were done by the government. So primary culpability lies with the government for its gross and unacceptable violations of commonly accepted principles of warfare.
But those have been nakedly apparent for years now and explicitly yes. called out by the United States, by the United Nations. There's no mystery about it. So yes. we know this, and yet at the same time, once that is known, and there are powers who could do something about it, and I get the history, I get that Americans don't want to be intervening, still, here's the end point. McCain sees a whole international system unraveling. Anybody looks at that and thinks, my God, where is moral accountability for this as it extends beyond the direct perpetrators?
Yes, I get your point. Look, in the summer of 2011, just months into the rebellion in Syria, President Obama called for Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, to step aside. And since then, the U.S. has been unwilling to take any steps to influence the situation in terms of action within Syria. Action
well, I mean, we've been in the CIA has been in there giving some arms. And
yes,
and
we have been training vetted forces. We've been doing a lot of that in Jordan. But those forces are relatively unimportant on the overall, if you will, spectrum of opposition forces. But, for example, we have not intervened in the air. I agree with Martha Myers. We have aircraft flying missions over Raqqa in the northeast. I think it would be very salutary for the U.S. to knock down Syrian helicopters and jets that are bombing civilian areas.
Should they knock down Russian jets that are bombing Aleppo, including, we're told, hospitals?
I understand that difficulty. The Russians, of course, intervened in September of 2015, and I'm not advocating that we should be in air warfare with the Russians. But I certainly think there's a strong moral argument for acting against the Syrian Air Force. And we have the capacity to do that, for that matter, without flying over Syria. We can use standoff weapons to do that, particularly against Syrian jets. It's relatively easy from a military standpoint. There's been a reluctance. Sorry. Mm-hmm. There's been a reluctance to provide anti-aircraft weapons to opposition forces. We've been willing to provide anti-tank weapons, but not anti-aircraft weapons. In my opinion, we should be revisiting that policy.
But that's out of the fear that they would end up in the hands of the many, many Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups who might use those to take down American or other aircraft. I mean, for that matter, you know, you've got the problem almost of perhaps the American government talking against Assad, but being afraid of him not being there, with ISIS growing on his eastern flank and many Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups
opposed
to him.
Well, I think you have something. I think you have something there. To borrow a term from economics, there's a revealed preference on the part of U.S. policy. And that is to say, U.S. policymakers have a hard time imagining an acceptable Syrian government after the current regime is toppled. They look at Syria and they see that the strongest forces on the ground are groups like Fatah al-Sham, which is Al-Qaeda affiliated, the Islamic State, and so on. And that's become worse with the defeat in Aleppo. Why? Because the Free Syrian Army, which was a more acceptable force from the standpoint of U.S. interest, was largely represented in Aleppo. And they're much weaker today than they were before the siege of Aleppo began in July. So I do think there's something to the notion that the U.S. does not want to see this regime in Syria toppled and replaced by an unknowable collection of unsavory forces.
Net result, the U.S. and the international community looking pretty ineffectual as we've seen all this suffering unfold in Syria. Focal point, Aleppo. But maybe people just don't want a role in that. Richard Norton, Martha Myers, Ben Tao, please stand by. Lots of callers here. Let's go to New York, Buffalo, New York. Don is calling. Hi, Don, you're on the air. What do you think?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I've been listening. I like the panel. Everyone's making a lot of sense. But one thing I want to say is you mentioned morals. You know, I think we lost morals when we invaded Iraq and Afghanistan with really no reason. So for us to be...
No reason in Afghanistan? I mean, Al-Qaeda organized 9/11 out of Afghanistan.
Okay. Well, but for the destruction that we've done in that country, and what have we really done? Nothing afterwards to really help the people? Same thing in Iraq. I mean, if you look at it from a standpoint of morals, we're out there bombing and killing people left and right, and now we're expecting Russia to do something different. No, do unto others as you want done to yourself. So this is what I'm seeing. I'm seeing Russia using our own techniques and tactics against us. We just saw it right now with the breaches with emails. So for us to go out there and try to be at the forefront of morals, I think we have to change a little bit first. I think we've got to take a diplomatic standpoint here with Russia. We can't just start bombing. We can't go in there doing things that are going to cause World War III, because that's what could happen here.
Don, let me pick it up right there. Ben Taub, I have to draw a line there saying Russia's picking up on our techniques. I mean, they're bringing sort of the Chechnya full bombardment here. I don't think that's the American way. On the other hand, we've got a lot of involvement now going into Mosul, and civilians are suffering there as we try and take that away from ISIS. On the other hand, we've armed Saudi Arabia, and in Yemen, where the Saudis have been bombing heavily, you've got mass suffering there and the danger of mass starvation. You hear the deep disillusionment in our caller, Ben, on the whole idea of intervening with moral purpose and coming out with clean hands.
Certainly. Well, our support of Saudi in Yemen is, I think, quite a damaging one to our own credibility because of the tactics that the Saudis are using, which it's quite clear they seem to have adopted because they've seen such impunity in Syria. They're bombing hospitals in Yemen. But I have to say, the tactics that whatever happened in Iraq, and this is not to excuse anything that happened in Iraq, civilians were not the targets of U.S. bombs. No doubt civilians die. In Mosul, we've had civilian casualties, and each time that happens, it's unacceptable, and it could be creating a greater problem down the line. But what's clear in Syria is that civilians are the targets of Russian and Syrian government aggression. And if you go through the Rome Statute, basically read off all the list of war crimes, and all of them are being perpetrated on a widespread, systematic scale there.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the agonies in Aleppo, the world's duty to protect, quote-unquote, and a moral accounting for what's going on these days and for some time now in Syria. Richard Norton is with us from the Frederick Party School of Global Studies at Boston University. Martha Myers is here. She's country manager for Turkey for the ARC Group. She was formerly country director for Syria for Save the Children International. Ben Taub has been reporting from the country, the region, for The New Yorker on what he finds fit the definition of war crimes there. You can join us. What do you think of the when the moral cost is clear, but the paths of intervention look so unpromising? What do you think is going to happen in Mosul, or what's happening right now in Yemen? Have Syria's actions and the world's inaction shown now that anything goes? Here's Samantha Power again, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., sort of beating the drum last week, pointing very heavily at Russia and Iran and Syria.
It should shame you. Instead, by all appearances, it is emboldening you. You are plotting your next assault. Are you truly incapable of shame? Is there literally nothing that can shame you? Is there no act of barbarism against civilians, no execution of a child that gets under your skin, that just creeps you out a little bit?
Mary in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you for calling, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling from Cincinnati. I'm a student at the University of Cincinnati. And as, you know, a young 20-year-old, I'm kind of curious as I believe as from a cosmopolitan standpoint, yeah, everyone should be held accountable. But how do us as regular citizens and not military officials necessarily hold our governments accountable or hold the United Nations accountable?
Richard Norton, that's a tall order for Mary in Cincinnati. But as citizens look at this and judging from the response we're getting online, people are all over the map on this. Not everybody wants the UN or the U.S. certainly in there. Mary wants to know where to lean, to lean toward accountability and help.
That's a very good question, and unfortunately the answer is not very reassuring. Public opinion polling in the U.S. has shown that there's not much support for getting engaged in a place like Syria. You recall when the issue of the red line came up in 2013.
This is over the use of chemical weapons. It was found to have been used, and there was no immediate consequence.
Yes, and Obama looked for support to the U.S. Congress and didn't find it. So both at the level of individual citizens and at the level of elected representatives, there hasn't been robust support for action. To the contrary. We'll see what happens with the Trump administration. Trump last week, in a kind of offhand comment, said that we would get the Gulf states. They have a lot of money. They have nothing else but money, he said. Mm. We'll get them to give us money, and we'll help create safe zones in Syria. But we'll see if anything comes of that. Certainly that hasn't been a choice that the Obama administration
and
has
made. And it's still American lives if you go in there militarily to create a safe zone. Ultimately, you're going to put American military
That's
lives
right.
at
you
risk.
You can't simply declare a safe zone. It has to be protected.
Ben Taub, Martha Myers, lots of response online here. Let me share some of it with you. Hill writes to us, I agree it's morally despicable what's going on, but why is it always our U.S., in parens, responsibility to fix things? There's one. And then here's another, Ben. Honestly, with Assad's steadfast refusal to step down, what would the international community have us do? A no-fly zone? With whose air force? A blockade with whose navy? Safe zones with whose army? As horrid as this is, the U.S. cannot police the world full stop. Neocon interventionism has failed. Pax Americana is over. We just don't know it yet. Ben?
I'd actually argue that it's in our interests to prevent this kind of atrocity. And I'd take it to a historical point, which is not widely part of the discussion, but I think it should be. So I was living on the Turkish-Syrian border in 2013, and right after and I was watching the rise of ISIS from right there. Yeah. I mean, and by that I mean, like, I was watching friends get kidnapped by them who were later beheaded. I had a close call with abduction myself. It was very, very, very clear to everybody who was on the border in the summer of 2013 that this group was going to become something terrible. But at the time, no matter what we reported, and there is reporting on this, no one seemed to care back home. No one seemed to even know what it was. No one seemed to care. The public seemed disinterested in learning about this group. And it was, and then 3 weeks after, or shortly after I left the border, there was the chemical weapons attack. There was all this talk about the red line, whether the U.S. should fight Assad. But most importantly, after that, about 2 weeks later, ISIS and the moderate rebels, who had sort of been accommodating them but didn't like them, started killing each other. And at that time, ISIS was comprised of about 3,000 or 4,000 guys. They didn't control any cities. They just had patches of territory. And if the U.S., and I argued this at the time, if the U.S. had gone in and actually supported the moderates now that they were separated from the extremists that made them unsavory to begin with, then ISIS could have been eliminated somewhat quickly. And it took a year of waiting for them to grow, allowing tens of thousands of recruits to cross the Turkish-Syrian border and join the group before anyone seemed to notice that they were actually a threat. And that was after they took Mosul almost a year later and then started beheading the journalists that they were kidnapping while I was there. So it's in our interests to not allow these kinds of vacuums to grow.
So maybe a missed opportunity in that moment. But Martha Myers, we've got pushback on the entire characterization of what's going on there. Here's another listener. Peter writes, the overlay that the world community did nothing does not fit the facts. The facts are, this is just one listener writing, that the U.S. created and fueled an insurgency in order to undermine the Syrian government, which, if successful, would have put the entire Syrian population at the mercy of dangerous and sadistic forces. I think he means ISIS / Al-Qaeda. All the blame may be laid on the doorstep of Washington. What do you make of that depiction of what's happened here, Martha?
I believe that that's historically inaccurate, and it's my direct observation. It's historically inaccurate. Syrians rose in March 2011, peacefully demonstrating in streets throughout Syria, asking for reform. They did not ask for the overthrow of the al-Assad regime initially. They were brutally attacked by that very repressive regime, and you had the appearance of the Free Syria Army, which was a fairly moderate group who was initially dedicated to trying to protect peacefully unarmed civilians who were demonstrating. I agree with Ben. We failed, and we have failed, and we have failed to support that group, and everything has become more violent, and there are now many actors in what has become a proxy war. And vacuums where groups like ISIS have sprung up, it's water under the bridge. But I do not believe, and I do not know, that the United States caused this conflict. I believe that the government of Syria's extremely repressive and controlling and exploitative character has caused this conflict. And our failure to act as an international community has contributed to its proliferation, the proliferation of actors and the growing levels of violence.
Leaving us in 2016 with our Secretary of State decrying what John Kerry calls nothing short of massacre, indiscriminate slaughter, a cynical policy of terrorizing civilians. Charleston, South Carolina. Don, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Well, history, if a besieged force situation is hopeless, and it has been hopeless for a long time, it's the absolute responsibility of the commander to negotiate the best surrender he can. And I realize that surrendering to Assad forces could be very dangerous, but the United States and Russia could have been very helpful in protecting them if they surrender. But and I also realize there's no one clearly in charge. It's kind of a hodgepodge as a commanders. But
why didn't the rebels initiate a surrender and hope to lead the people out in some kind of safety? I don't know if Russia was interested in protecting. On the other hand, I mean, Russia's been bombing. On the other hand, I don't know if the United States was materially directly interested in protecting either. Richard Norton, what about this notion? If rebel commanders who were there among the civilians in Aleppo understood their circumstance, it was their duty to surrender and look for some kind of merciful exit.
Look, the opposition has suffered tremendously under the onslaught of the government, and yet they evince a strong commitment to toppling this government. That may not have been their objective when the demonstrations began in 2011.
They wanted reform.
But today they want to topple this government, and they're doggedly committed to that goal.
Is that now a hopeless goal? You can look at, when you look at Aleppo, the streets of Aleppo.
I don't think so. I certainly think that Aleppo is an important marking point in the struggle. But the Syrian army is quite weak. If they have 25,000 effective forces that they can count on, that would surprise me.
What's it matter if you have the Russian Air Force and Iran in there with all kinds of special forces and militia?
You're right. You have militias coming in from Iraq, from Lebanon, militiamen from Afghanistan and Pakistan, and plus the Air Force of the Russians. Without those adjunct forces, the government would be in a much, much more difficult situation
but
than
there
it is
they
today.
Are. And they appear to be winning, not letting up.
Yes, but is it possible with these militia forces, which are almost 100% Shi'i Muslim, to control the country, which is predominantly Sunni Muslim? I doubt it. I doubt it very seriously.
Jennifer in Carlisle, Massachusetts. Jennifer, thank you for calling. You're on the air. Hello, Jennifer. Are you there? May have lost that call. Let's get another here. Green Bay, Wisconsin. Saeed is calling. Hi, Saeed. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Unlike your previous caller, I don't believe we lost the moral high ground in Afghanistan or Iraq. We lost the moral high ground in Syria, not only by our acts of omission, but also by our acts of commission. It's important to remember that at the beginning of this, in 2011, our then ambassador went and stood with the demonstrators. Our president and our secretary of state said Assad must go. We poured fuel on this fire. So we are responsible. But now you must ask why. Why does this Nobel Peace Prize winner, our president that we have, allow us to fall into this position of immorality? And the answer to that is because he subordinated his policy in Syria to his desire to sign a deal with Iran. And therefore, he did not confront Iran in Syria in the way that he should have. The consequences of this are severe, because now Syria will be a client state of Iran. Iran has now established a landmass from Iraq to Syria, to Lebanon, to border Israel. The world will pay a price for this.
Martha Meyer, how about it? Martha Meyer, the assertion there that President Obama subordinated the Syrian issue to getting the nuclear deal with Iran, and now you hear Saeed's conclusion.
Yeah. Well, you know, Saeed is correct that the development of the conflict in Syria into a proxy war and our allowing and actually in some ways encouraging it to be cast as a Sunni-Shia conflict is problematic. I do not see the United States as having walked away from what I see to be moral responsibility to protect civilians as a result of trying to get the Iran nuclear deal. What I see it as is that the Obama administration came in and seemed to analyze the situation in the Middle East, that Iraq and Syria are somehow identical and the conflicts are identical and the history would be identical, and therefore we should not get involved in more Middle Eastern conflicts. I don't think anybody wants to see U.S. boots on the ground in Syria. I don't want to see U.S. boots on the ground, and I haven't ever met a Syrian who wants U.S. boots on the ground. But there are other ways to help and assist forces that can make things come right. And so, no, I don't think it was the Iran deal. I think it was Americans being gun-shy, if I can put it that way, after unhappy engagements in other places like Afghanistan and Iraq.
One more call here. John in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. John, you're on the air. What do you think?
I agree with that last comment. I think most Americans are tired. My belief, though, overall in all this is that all of these things go back to the world wars, number one, and these countries that were arbitrarily orders that were made. And then secondly, my final point is just I feel like regardless, we're sort of at a powder keg situation where it's going to be some small event that kind of tips us over into, that kind of forces our hand. And I'll get off there.
Forces our hand in what direction? You're saying another big war if we get in there now, John?
I think there's great potential for that. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, marshalling of forces. You know, Russia is...
Yeah, they're there. Our time is short. Let us take it. Ben Taub, do you see an accounting happening somewhere here? And if somebody tries to force it, the U.S., is there a risk of just a bigger war, more suffering?
Well, I think there are certainly ways to mitigate some of this violence and reduce the capacity of the Russians and the Syrians to commit war crimes that would not trigger World War III. For instance, if you bomb a runway, then the jets can't take off. If you do airdrops into areas under siege, food and medicine, I mean, a Syrian government is not going to shoot down an American jet that is dropping. It would be preposterous for the Syrians to shoot down an American jet that's dropping food and medicine.
Russians have put in new air defenses and made a lot of noise about it there.
That's true, but I mean, does Syria want the U.S. to go on all-out war? And I don't think Russia does either.
Is the criminal court going to come in and take names and find an accounting, a moral accounting there ultimately, Ben? Or this is just blood under the bridge?
It has to happen. It has to happen. And I think we're going to have the same conversation in 3 months because there are still parts of Syria that Assad doesn't control, and they will not change their tactics as they try to do so.
We're watching with a little bit clearer view of what's going on. We're grateful to all three of you for doing that, painful as it is to watch. Ben Taub, contributing writer for The New Yorker, thank you very much for being with us from New York today.
Thank you.
Martha Myers with the ARC Group, country manager for Turkey there. Martha, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure.
And Richard Norton at the Frederick Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. Thank you so much for coming in.
Always happy to be with you.
Listeners, thanks for all your input. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.